Welcome to the Drama Teacher Podcast, brought to you by Theater Folk, the Drama Teacher Resource Company. I'm Lindsay Price. Hello, I hope you're well. Thanks for listening. This is episode 213, and you can find any links to this episode in the show notes, which are at theaterfolk.com/episode213. Did you know it's Frankenstein's birthday this month? Happy birthday, Frankenstein! Well, more accurately, it is the birthday of Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley, Mary Shelley, the author of the classic gothic romance, Frankenstein. Our guest today tackled this iconic story and adapted it into a play for high schools. Not an easy feat, right? There are many movie adaptations, many parodies. It's Frankenstein, not Frankenstein. That was the worst ever, don't you think? I think. Anyway, many versions of the monster. So how do you make it theatrical? How do you adapt it to the high school stage and high school budgets? How do you make it current to the student climate, right? We can't publish a play that's all guys and all the great parts. So many questions. Let's get to the answers. I'll see you on the other side. Hello! Thank you, everybody, for listening. I'm here today with Laramie Dean. Hello, Laramie.
Hello, Lindsay.
Tell everybody where in the world you are.
I am in Missoula, Montana.
Missoula, Montana. Very nice. We're here and we're going to talk about a lot of things. We're going to talk about you. We're going to talk about Frankenstein Among the Dead, which is this lovely, this lovely thing. It's a brand new play here at Theater Folk. And we are going to, we're going to start with you and teaching. How long have you been a drama teacher?
I started teaching theater in 2003 as an assistant to one of the professors at the University of Montana, where I had just recently finished my bachelor's degree in acting, and I was sort of at odds. I didn't know what I wanted to do anymore. And Dr. Jillian Campana is a huge influence on me and my career, asked me to come and assistant direct the university's production of the Laramie Project, and I had never directed before. And she said, oh, you'll be great. And we had a student who was a freshman in the program, and he was very hard to reach, and she was having trouble directing him. And she said, will you work with this guy after rehearsal? And I was like, And I sat down with him and we talked and I gave him some suggestions and some direction, and he changed for the better. And all of a sudden I went, oh my God, I can do this. I'm actually good at this. So I went back to grad school, and Jillian gave me lots of opportunities, TA. And then I got my own classes and I had a playwriting class. And finally, several years down the road, I decided to become a high school theater teacher and ended up with my job at Hellgate High School, which is the most fantastic name a theater teacher like me could possibly work at.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about horror, which I think, that I think is just even a better title or school title when you like horror and you write horror and you work at Hellgate High. I just think that's fantastic.
I agree.
So what was it, do you think? Because what was your high school theater experience like? Let's start there. What is it like for you when you were in high school?
My personal experience. Yeah. I actually went to Hellgate my freshman and sophomore year of high school, and I was lucky to be able to take drama classes. They had drama classes, not full time, which I'm also super lucky to be able to teach full time theater classes at Hellgate. And my first play I auditioned for at Hellgate was actually Dracula. When we talk about Frankenstein in a little bit, we'll also talk about how I was never a huge Frankenstein fan as a kid. I was always more into Dracula and the Wolfman. But I auditioned for Dracula as a freshman, did not get cast, was devastated, tried again in the fall, and in the Crucible. Hellgate did the Crucible. and was cast as Thomas Putnam. Had a great time. It was depressing. It was November and dark, and we were reading the Scarlet Letter. Well, yeah, not a musical version, not a fun version, no happy ending.
What?
I know. That Arthur Miller, what can you do with him? So then we ended up doing The Foreigner, and I was a Ku Klux Klan member. I had one line and didn't show up till the end. My drama teacher sequestered me and my fellow KKK characters into a completely separate green room, kept us separate from everybody else. I should ask her why. Hey, Tammy, if you're watching this, why did you do that? It was 20 years ago. I'm sure you remember. But it was fun. And then we were in Missoula because my mom was in law school. I'm actually originally from a little farming community in far northeastern Montana. And after mom finished law school, we moved back to the farm, which was tough. And there were my graduating class in the little town that I moved back to is 10 people. Yes. And my English teacher decided to do a play. It was awful, but it was fun. It was called Hail the Hunkering Hero. I'm sorry if the playwright for that is somewhere out of the world, but it was pretty bad. And I played a football-loving Appalachian hillbilly character. So it was a stretch. But it was fun. We had a good time. And when I went back to the University of Montana, I sort of wandered around for a while and took an acting for non-majors class kind of by accident that I stumbled into. And the graduate student that was teaching it said, "Why aren't you a theater major?" I was like, and he sort of convinced me to do that, cast me in Three Penny Opera. And then, well, boom, 20 years later, I'm a published playwright with theater folk.
Yes, you are. Okay, so yes, so that is the end of the story, is that we're going to get to Frankenstein Among the Dead. When did you start? But you've been writing for your students. That wasn't the first play that you wrote for your students, right? Is it? That's a good question. Is this the play that you wrote for your students?
I like that I have to think about it. No, Alice in Wonderland. We did Alice in Wonderland first. I wanted to build my program up. I think it was my second or third year at Hellgate, and I wanted to build the program, and I love Alice in Wonderland, and it touched some very specific button in the community, because up until then we'd had pretty good audiences, but Alice in Wonderland, we have a beautiful auditorium, 565 seats, and we sold out every night for our three performances, and I was like, oh, I guess everyone likes Alice in Wonderland. And it was fun. It was big cast, crazy design, colors, lots of lunacy, and everyone loved it. So I don't remember why I decided to do Frankenstein. Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do. In my intermediate drama classes, I teach a design unit, and we do this toy theater project where they study a little bit about toy theater and the history of toy theater, and then I give them literature or children's plays. And every year, somebody does something really super cool with one of the children's plays, and that year, one of my really awesome students, Emma Harrison, had done Frankenstein, and they, what did it do? It had a lightning bolt built. Of course, the sets are pretty much just about this big, and she had a lightning bolt built into the back of the set, the upstage wall of the set, and a flashlight behind it that would light up whenever the monster came to life or something scary would happen. And I went, oh, that's really cool. That's really exciting. And I thought, hey, I'll do Frankenstein next. And I think that I had spring break, I sat down, and we actually had a lovely spring that year, 2015, I think. And I sat on my front porch and drank coffee and started writing Frankenstein and had a great time. So that was my second play that I wrote for my students, I think.
And what's that experience like when you have something and you bring it in and you just sort of lay it out for them? And like, what is their feedback like? What's it like when you like work with them?
They tend to love it. They brag about it a little bit sometimes, like, oh, our theater teacher writes his own plays. And I'm like, yeah, it's fun. And we can change things or tailor things specifically for whatever cast happens to exist. If a line doesn't work, when we did Dracula 2 years ago, I actually the second night, I called the lead actress that played Mina, and I was like, I want to write a new ending to the show. I want to write a new little like five sentence monologue at the end of Dracula. If I send that to you now, can you memorize it before tonight? And she was like, yes. So we could do cool things like that, where I was like, oh, well, you know how this works. It's you're in the middle of a run, and actually, when I was doing my PhD in playwriting and speech communication in Carbondale, Illinois, at Southern Illinois University, the culminating project for both the MFA playwrights and the PhD playwrights is you write a play and the university stages it. And I was working with a director named Tom Kidd. He was fabulous. And he was very upfront with the actors at the very beginning of the process. He said, this is a living play. It's a living play. And it has the possibility or the potential to change all the way up until the final performance. And I felt kind of bad because we went into it with a certain amount of characters, and we cast it. And then about 2 weeks into rehearsal, we realized that one of the characters wasn't working and we had to cut her. Oh, I know, but we kept the actress. There was a chorus. I'm a huge, huge proponent of chorus parts. Paul Vogel uses it in How I Learned to Drive. Just read a fabulous adaptation of Jason and Medea by Barbara Lindsay, I think, that uses a chorus really effectively. They put multiple characters. I love that. So we were able to shift this actress, like, okay, you're not totally cut from the show, but now you're a chorus member. Yeah.
You know, I think that I really like that phrase, living play. I actually almost think that that's what we should be using when we talk to students about writing student work. Because they're just so, they get so locked in sometimes, yes. You know, and they don't want to change, and they get to the end of that first draft and they don't want to go onto a second or third. And
I feel that too a lot of times too. And I tell them that I feel this too. I want to be perfect right away. I want to be perfect the first time. And the lovely thing about a play is that you can read it yourself. You can have a reading. That's the other nice thing is normally I'm able to gather enough either former students or actor friends of mine to sit down in our house. we call it the little theater. I have this little proscenium arch thing in our TV room, and get a bunch of people together and have a reading. And of course, you know, that helps. But then it isn't until you're actually working or staging it and it's on its feet that you go, oh, this is not working, or oh, this line isn't working. There's a line in Frankenstein that was, I didn't even realize it was such a stupid line until the actress said, it was a locket in a pocket, she said. And we all broke up. And I was like, oh, God, locket in a pocket. No. So we were able to cut that and make that change. But it's so great for them to learn that. I'm sure their English teachers, history teachers, wherever they write papers, have been saying, hey, guys, drafts. You know, you kind of have to cut through stuff and rearrange and reconfigure. And a play being a living document that, you know, Tennessee Williams changed Cat on a Hot Tin Roof years down the road. I mean, you have the power, the potential to do that, which I think is great. I think it's a great lesson for them to learn too.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and just that living, it is not a play until you see it and you hear it,
which is, right.
which is the downside to doing a playwriting unit. You know, like sometimes it's just not possible to stage 30 plays, you know, if you have a large class, and to trying to figure out alternatives to doing that. No, I'm with you, man. Like seeing it, is when you see it and you hear it and you go, oh,
that might not be how that sounded in my head.
Yes.
Oh, and you know, I in my advanced theater class, my philosophy for them is I want them to learn how to build theater from the ground up. So we do a lot of devised theater. We do a playwriting unit at the second half of the, it's a year-long course in the second half of the year. And right now we're doing Greek theater. So we just read Medea and then let that Jason Medea play. And we're looking at Hippolytus and Phaedra. And they're all going to write their own 10-minute play they have to study their own independent Greek play. So some of them will get the frogs, the birds, Electra, fun things like that. And they're going to write their own 10-minute play that's inspired somehow by that. Then we'll read them all. And my playwriting professor at Carbondale, David Rush, had a really fantastic methodology for readings. Because, you know, so often the audience wants to write your play for you. So we set it up where the playwrights have to come with questions ready for the audience. Of course, the audience is the rest of the class. So they write the play, they use the actors in class that they have to work with, and then they ask questions of this work. How'd you feel about this? How did this work? What did you think about this? And the audience is not allowed to say, well, what I would have done or what you should have done, which, you know, that can be so frustrating as a playwright. It's like, well, this is my play. And we do a lot of like, how many of you felt this way about this moment? And we'll show of hands. And so it's really lovely and very scientific.
Right. And also, because the worst thing that a playwright can do is stand up and say, what did you think of my play? Because you won't get that scientific response. You'll get,
no,
I liked it, or silence. And that's not helpful. And I love the idea, and I'm going to repeat it because I think everyone should do this, is if you're going to have, you should have your playwright sort of craft their own feedback form.
Yes.
You know, they should be the ones asking the questions. And that way the audience doesn't, it's a very stressful thing to be asked what you think about
a piece of art. I may have been guilty of doing the Montana Repertory Theater commissions local playwrights to do a touring show, an educational touring show for the state of Montana. And right now I'm working with my friend Rosie on a play called Morgan and Merlin, about Morgan Le Fay, King Arthur's evil witch half-sister, and Merlin, who is, you know, Merlin. And I sent her a new draft. And I was like, what'd you think? Did you like it? Going, oh, why are you doing that?
Because it's a living thing. It's our baby. We want everybody to love it. That's what we want.
So I have 20 kids in this class, and they'll all be able to write their own play. We'll do stage readings. And this year, I think I'm putting them into little 4 or 5 person groups, and they will choose one of the plays that we've done to expand into a 20-25 minute play. And then they'll create it, they'll design it, costume it, adapt it, however they want to do it to fit the specifications of their group. And then we'll do them in May. We'll see them in May. So I thought it was a nice solution to how do you do a playwriting unit for 20 high school kids.
Yeah.
It's been a lot of trial and error for me.
Well, that's the name of the game, though, isn't it? It's like fail again. Oh, okay, now that works. Now we got it. So on that note, let's talk about writing Frankenstein Among the Dead. That's our brand new play here at Theater Folk. The link is in the description. You can go and read sample pages. You can go and get this wonderful adaptation, is the word I'm looking for, adaptation of this very classic story. I think it's told in a way that I had never seen before, which is why we published it. And so what was your approach? How did you approach adapting Frankenstein?
Well, like I said, I've never been a Frankenstein fan, and I tend to gravitate towards stories with strong female characters in them. I love me a strong female character. And of course, when you're doing educational theater, in my experience, I've tended to have more women than men. And it's a challenge sometimes trying to find pieces that will work for everybody, but particularly to sort of give opportunities to these fabulous women. And Frankenstein, as Mary Shelley points out in Frankenstein Among the Dead, doesn't have, I think there are 3 female characters. There's the mother, there's Justine, the servant, and there's Elizabeth. Oh, and there's the dead bride, but she gets chopped up and never comes to life. And Elizabeth's whole job is to just be ready to marry Victor, and then she marries him, and then the monster kills her. And it's a really iconic moment. I think if you look at Universal's Frankenstein, ooh, actually, I have this. This is a beautiful, this is my secret to adaptation with literature. You find graphic novel adaptations and you see, because they're visual, right? So this is the adaptation of Universal Monsters Frankenstein, and here's this scene. I think it's right here where
a little higher.
Like that.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, where Elizabeth gets strangled by the monster. And that was the part that always scared me, fascinated me when I was a kid. It was the one part of the novel that I was like, oh. But then I was like, ah, oh, she's pretty. She marries him and then she dies. And she's really there just to demonstrate the monster's savageness and make Victor angry. And I was having none of it. So I really wanted to approach, the story in a different way, like you said. When I was a little kid, my parents are fabulous. My mother particularly has nurtured and encouraged my interest in horror and scariness. And so Santa Claus, when I was eight maybe, brought me The Bride of Frankenstein on VHS for Christmas. Is it back there? Oh, yeah. So you can see my little poster behind me that I got at Universal Studios this year when we went to LA for Christmas. But The Bride of Frankenstein I thought was interesting because she does come to life, but she doesn't really talk. She hisses a lot and then they blow her up. So I was sort of struck by that, but I really wanted to approach this story and say, hey, what can I do for the women? What can I do for the women?
Write them good parts.
That's what I wanted to do.
Always write them good parts.
Right. So intrigued by Mary Shelley. And I, as I was doing research and preparing for this, I found a really interesting, an article or a story or something about Mary Shelley and how she, her children kept dying, her babies kept dying. And I thought, there's this really interesting link between a writer and how, as we said, your plays are your children, your stories are your children. And of course, we're doing Into the Woods at Hellgate right now because I'm a crazy person. And that's what, you know, the story escapes you. The story does what the story wants to do. Careful the tale you tell. Stories, wishes are children, right? You let them go and they go off and do their own thing. And I love that idea that Mary Shelley was this writer with children that wouldn't live. And she made this terrifying monster that scared even her. So that was kind of my jumping off place, was Mary Shelley writing about this monster, and then she's wandering around with this candle and the monster appears and she loves it. She's so excited. She doesn't scream and run away. She's like, "Ooh, come with me. You're awesome."
Well, of course, you know, why not?
Like you do.
Like you do. What is it, do you think, that we are, what attracts us to horror? Because you also, this is not your only rodeo of horror.
No.
You also have a lovely podcast. Please tell everybody the name of your podcast.
Oh, thank you. It is called This Place Scares Us. You can find it at thisplacescaresus.com. We're on iTunes. We're all over the place. Do a basic Google search. My friend Katya and I sit down. My friend Katya and I sit down and we talk every week about scary things. We're actually recording tonight about shapeshifters and the so-called horror of hybridity, and how you may look like one thing if you're a shapeshifter, but you can become something else, and how that disrupts people's lives in horror fiction and science fiction. But yeah, so we talk about all the things that scare us. Probably not a podcast for children. If you are a high school kid, maybe wait till you're old enough to vote. And then
you can go ahead. So why? What is it about horror that attracts you?
It, me personally, since I was a little kid, I wrote to Stephen King when I was seven, and asked for a copy of, Cycle of the Werewolf. I had seen the movie Silver Bullet, scared American Werewolf in London, scared the hell out of me, but I loved it. I loved that feeling of being scared and being freaked out. I would run out of the room and not be able to watch, and I would come creeping back in. And so I wrote to Stephen King and he sent me an autographed copy of the book because he's an awesome guy. And that kind of pushed me down this road. I love to be scared. And anymore, it isn't even scared so much. It's what interests me, I guess. But audiences respond to it, and it's tricky on stage. I would love to explore more of the how horror works or doesn't work on stage. Vampire plays particularly don't tend, vampire musicals, I should say. Dracula seems to live forever, but vampire musicals don't tend to do very well traditionally. And I would love to sort of, I don't know. I wrote a play last summer, my first non-adapted, based on literature, about an old woman who has something comes every night and bangs on her window and nobody believes her, and she's 80 and they think she's ready for the home, but it's this real scary thing. And I would love to stage it and see if it works, I guess, on stage. The scary can work on stage, or it might not work. And again, that trial and error thing we talked about too. But people love it. People love to be scared. When things are tricky or troublesome, the reason that the Universal Monster movies were so popular in the 40s was because of World War II. People wanted to escape and they want their fears to be manageable. And when you take something that is hard to deal with in your real life, but you make it deal withable as a monster, as a werewolf, as a Frankenstein monster, as a vampire that has real solutions to dealing with those problems, I think it makes them feel better. We can sort of have catharsis. Catharth? Is that a word? We can catharth.
Yes, we can catharth.
We can catharth.
We're going to catharth. I think that is an interesting and absolutely right down the path about horror, maybe even horror today, because by far are the shows that we have that delve in horror, you know, we have a Shuddersome, which deals with Edgar Allan Poe and Frankenstein, and we have another writer, Stephen Stack, who does the combo of horror and comedy. I think what you hit on really nicely is a manageable fear with a very solvable problem,
Yep.
And I think that life right now is very much unsolvable problems, it seems. The 21st century seems to be a lot of unsolvable problems and fears. Like our teens today, I think, I certainly don't want to speak for them, but there just seems to be a lot of anxiety and a lot of fear. So why not throw all that into something like Frankenstein Among the Dead, right? Where you're just...
Right.
Where the horror is manageable. And on
stage. I agree. Well, yeah. And it is. It's you are able to be scared and then go home. And the monsters destroy the monsters, which I explore a lot in Frankenstein Among the Dead too. The characters of May and Clive have just come out of watching The Bride of Frankenstein. And they're talking about these very things. They're having this discussion about the bride and how they blew her up. And then, of course, they are brutally murdered by the monster.
Oops. Spoiler alert.
I think it's in the first 10 pages.
Characters are killed by the monster. Just in case you didn't know, Frankenstein.
He is not writing love sonnets and giving
Although, up we have a middle school play called Frankenstein versus Horrendous Goo, where he does write love letters. But that's a different Frankenstein. My eyes watch a different Frankenstein. You know what's interesting, too, is that it seems that horror is the genre these days where, like, we get lots of calls for, like, we can't say certain words. We can't have relationships on stage. We can't. No one ever calls us up about our horror plays and says we can't kill anybody on stage. It's the same thing with Shakespeare, eh? You know, like Shakespeare seems to get away with like everything. Horror's kind of the same way. It's almost like it's the only safe genre in
when it's
in
not
school.
Real. Yeah. It's not real. I think they feel that way too. It's not real. And I was, when we were doing the initial production of Frankenstein, and the neck breaking, that horrifies me. Which is why it's in there. It's scary. It's brutal. No one had a problem with it. In Dracula, when we did Dracula, impalings and severed heads and blood. But, in the novel Dracula, he cuts his chest open and has the heroine drink blood from his chest. We did not do that. We did the hand. It would seem safer. Because people did. They would have an issue with that. And my high school is pretty pretty liberal. We can do a lot. I have a little list of no-no words. And then common sense, I think, takes over. Common sense.
I like it when people use common sense. Okay, as we wrap up here, let's talk about producing. You talked a little bit about this, about how the fact that horror can work on stage and it can't work on stage.
It might not.
It might not work on stage. So as we wrap up, having directed it, what are some do's and don'ts? What are some good do's for putting horror on the stage, and what are some really good don'ts?
Oh, gosh, that's so tough. I think part of the issue is that we have movies. And one of the things in television, I tell my students all the time, what can the theater do that movies and television can't? They do realism so, naturalism so well. So what does the theater offer? And what's one of the reasons why I like to do plays very minimalistically, suggested sets, platforms. We had a window in Frankenstein, just a window, just hanging out, big gothic window. Because 100 years of movies, 70 years of television, and they've seen it. They've seen ghosts, they've seen vampires, they've seen werewolves turn into dust and change shape with special effects. And so what can the theater offer? And of course, there's fun solutions. I have found that, I keep coming back to the neck breaking, the death. It's almost like there's this fine line between, will they believe it or not? They know that these are kids playing these parts and that no one is really dead, and you kind of have to get them to suspend their disbelief. So I think I found that the tech helps if you have really awesome lights. I'm super fortunate. My husband was not a theater person until he met me. And he has sort of trained himself, and with help from some of our friends and my former technical director, has learned to make sets and do lights. There's 150 light cues in Into the Woods because he's amazing. And we spend 10 hours yesterday hanging and focusing lights. So he uses light a lot. When we did Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House a couple years ago, very minimal sets, lots of lights and shadow. And I find that the more you go into what can your sort of theater magic accomplish, the more that the audience will buy into what you're doing, which seems counterintuitive because you're making it less realistic looking. But I think the audiences, particularly who are not used to theater, in Missoula, we're lucky. We have a pretty big theater population. We have lots of live theater that kids can go to. But for the most part, their experience tends to be with Shakespeare reading in their English class out loud. And that is a big bummer for a lot of them, I think. So to introduce them to theater and say, hey, this is what theater can accomplish. Like, it doesn't have to be literal. It doesn't have to be realistic. This platform is the lecture hall in Frankenstein. It's the mountaintop where the monster pours out his soul. The lights, the shadow, gobos, I mean, all this really cool stuff. If you're going to do horror on stage, go expressionistic, kids. Go expressionistic. Shadows, lights, interesting shapes. Texture. We had a monster box. I think it's credited in the play. Emma Harrison and Nora Gibbons did the monster box because, you know, you have to come up with some way for the monster to be alive. And I don't really specify it so much. We found this big glass shower case, I would call it, and they decorated it with lights and clamps and all kinds of weird sciencey looking things, and the lights did the rest. Lightning and thunder sound effects all did the rest. So trust your tech, I think. Trust your designers is the other thing I would say. If you're going to do horror on stage, trust your tech and your designers.
Well, if you don't do everything realistically, because that means it can all live in the imagination of the audience, which is why there's so much in the 18th century, there's so much horror, you know? Because it's all 19th century, it's all in the minds of their audience. Like, it's they create the horror.
Yes. So that's this is where Stephen King and I disagree. I'm a huge fan of Shirley Jackson. She's my favorite author of Haunting of Hill House, The Lottery, We Have Always Lived in the Castle. And her whole thing was not to show, because often, like you said, what's scary is what the audience imagines in themselves. Stephen King likes to rip the door off and show whatever is lurking outside of it. I think sometimes it's scarier to let the audience imagine what is going on. But a play like Frankenstein too, where we had some really visceral moments. The moment where Victor dreams his mother is wandering through the streets and she's dead. And the actress did this weird, like, kind of jerky walk, and her back was to us, and he comes up and she turns around and she has a skull mask, and the audience loved it. There was a really freaky little kind of a jolt of a moment. Trying to think what else. Oh, Henry's death. These really violent, scary moments. Sometimes, yes, you should show them. Sometimes not.
It all depends, right? Yep. Use your common sense. That's what we're going to end on. Use lights, please. And your common sense.
Common sense, please, everybody, please.
Awesome. Laramie, thank you so much for talking to me. We have Frankenstein Among the Dead, theaterfolk.com.
Lots of roles for women. Lots of roles for women. Good roles
for women. Roles for women. Use your common sense. All right. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lindsay.
Thank you, Laramie. Before we go, let's do some theater folk news. It's a play feature, it's a play feature, it's time to feature a play. So of course we're going to talk about Frankenstein Among the Dead by Laramie Dean. This is a new play in the Theater Folk catalog, and this is a story that traditionally focuses on Dr. Frankenstein and the monster. Two great parts, but for guys. And Laramie's play has those two major roles, but the play shares the story from the perspective of two women. So thunder and lightning tear apart the night sky while two young women explore the story of Frankenstein, Mary Shelley, who wrote the original novel, and Elsa, mysterious and determined to learn Mary's secrets, including the most important of all, how to bring the dead to life. This play is gothic. Awesomely so. Filled with poetic language, filled with emotionally charged characters, filled with thunder and lightning, and of course, filled with the monster. So go to theaterfolk.com to read free sample pages from Frankenstein Among the Dead, or click the link in the show notes, theaterfolk.com/episode213. Finally, where can you find this podcast? Go to theaterfolk.com/podcast, and there you will see we are on iTunes, Android, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. That's theaterfolk.com/podcast. And that's where we're going to end. Take care, my friends. Take care.